PR.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. And I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Thousands of young immigrants in New York State are at risk of deportation after President Trump ended special protections earlier this year. New Yorkers and others are now suing to reverse the administration's policy change. Coming up in a couple of minutes, we talk to New York Focus's new immigration reporter and get all the details. But first, we've got news from Albany, where on Friday, New York Governor Kathy Hochul declared a health emergency to help New Yorkers get COVID vaccines. WNYC's Jimmy Vielkind reports on her executive order.
Hochul says uncertainty over federal vaccine policy is creating a barrier to getting COVID boosters this year. Her order allows pharmacists to distribute vaccines without an individual prescription.
I don't understand why you won't let families have the choice to protect their children's health. That's what this is about.
The order lasts 30 days. COVID vaccines will be available to people aged 3 and older. That's a broader group than the federal FDA recommended last month. That agency only approved COVID boosters for people 65 and older or with underlying medical conditions. Other states, including Massachusetts, have taken similar steps to increase access to COVID vaccines this year. In Albany, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
Thank you, Jimmy. We have more on that very story coming up in this program because Tim Bruno spoke to New York State Health Commissioner Dr. James McDonald on Radio Chatskill this morning. We have that full conversation coming up in the second half of this program. Next up in state news, what does it pay to be the mascot of Governor Hochul's new school phone ban? WNYC's John Campbell found the answer.
Everybody, Frankie.
Governor Hochul unveiled Frankie Focus at a middle school in Brooklyn last week with the help of the school principal. He's covered in shaggy neon green hair, and he's meant to tout the state's new ban on smartphones in public schools, which just went into effect. A spokesperson for the governor's office says Frankie will be played by a mix of staff volunteers and paid talent. For paid gigs, the actor inside the costume is getting $300 per event minus a 10% fee for a talent agency. That's according to a casting call from a couple weeks before Frankie's debut. The mascot's scheduled to show up at schools across the state through late next month. In Albany, I'm John Campbell for the New York Public News Network.
And thank you to the New York Public News Network for those reports. Well, New Yorkers are suing to reverse a Trump administration policy change that has upended the futures of tens of thousands of young immigrants in the state. Earlier today, I spoke to Isabel Taft, the immigration reporter at New York Focus, who's covering how the Trump administration's decision to end protections for youth with special immigrant juvenile status, abbreviated as SIJ, pronounced as SIJ, Special Immigrant Juvenile Status, that decision has put thousands at risk of deportation. Isabel Taft, welcome to your debut on the Local Edition.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So yeah, let's start off by explaining like the history on this. What is Special Immigrant Juvenile Status?
Sure. So special immigrant juvenile status was created by Congress in 1990 to offer a pathway to citizenship to young people who had been, to young immigrants who had been abused or neglected and could not return safely to their home countries. So for many years, this status quickly allows people to apply for a visa and get a green card and on the path to citizenship. But Congress had placed it in the employment-based visa category, so there are pretty tight limits on the number of visas available each year to people with SIJ. And so starting in the mid-2010s, you begin to see the number of SIJ-approved young people exceeding the number of visas that are available. So at that point, you have people who have been approved for this status, have been deemed vulnerable, can't return safely to their home countries, and yet no formal status is available to them at that point. So they have SIJ, but they don't yet have the ability to work legally They don't have protections from deportation, so that creates what's called the SIJ backlog.
The SIJ backlog, and they're kind of in a waiting game, but as you're saying there, you don't have the ability to work legally, as so many other issues with immigration, and you're also talking about people that then are kind of getting pushed to the margins of society.
Right, yeah, and they're having to just wait, different amounts of time. The wait list is increasingly long, kind of in this waiting game to begin their adult lives here in the U.S. But under the Biden administration in 2022, they created a deferred action policy somewhat similar to DACA that allowed people who'd been approved for SIJ to receive deferred action and then apply for work permits, be protected from deportation, kind of have a guarantee of security while they were waiting to apply for a visa.
And I'm just wondering, with that status, was this in any way a bipartisan effort? Was this something that was passed by legislation, or was this an executive order from President Biden?
From President Biden, that was an executive order, or I don't know if it was an executive order, but it was an administrative action. So it did not come from Congress, which has now made it vulnerable to revocation under the Trump administration, which is exactly what happened. But it was not, under Biden. There had been criticisms of the SIJ program going back to the first Trump administration, but this deferred action initiative protected tens of thousands of young immigrants with, fairly significant ties to the country already, with kind of backstories that indicated to the public, I think, the importance of protecting them. So it was not, one of the more controversial immigration decisions of the Biden administration.
And yet, as you just mentioned, things are changing under the Trump administration. So can you give me a little more detail on what exactly is changing now, and when did it start changing?
Sure. So in early April, immigration attorneys and young people applying for SIJ begin to notice that they are getting notifications that their SIJ petition has been approved, but they're not getting any information about deferred action. So under Biden, when you applied for SIJ, if you got approved, at the same time, you got a notice saying, and you have deferred action, so you can apply for a work permit, you're protected. Starting in April, those notices were not arriving. But it wasn't until 2 months later that the Trump administration formally announced that it had canceled the Biden administration's 2022 policy, that it was no longer considering deferred action for SIJ youth, and that is still the status quo. So now young people who are applying for this status, you could get approved, but you have no ability to work legally, and you are vulnerable to deportation.
How many young people in New York State, and as well as the whole country, could be affected by this policy change?
Yeah, so the best numbers that I've seen are a little bit out of date, going back to 2023, so they're probably larger now, given the large numbers of new arrivals we saw in the last few years. But in 2023, there were close to 20,000 New Yorkers who were caught in that SIJ backlog, many of whom then became protected by deferred action. So we're talking about, at a minimum, roughly 20,000 New Yorkers who were kind of in the position of having SIJ, but not yet a visa and green card. And then nationally, the number is about 200,000 people.
Wow. And, it's interesting that this becomes then a very New York issue, because New York has more of the folks with this status than any other state.
Yeah, that's right. According to the federal government, New York is home to more petitioners for SIJ than any other state. To some degree, that's not surprising, because New York has always attracted a lot of immigrants. And during the Obama administration, Central American communities on Long Island became kind of a destination for many Central American teenagers who were immigrating alone. And then more recently, with the migrants being bused from other states and people arriving from all over the world, there were, among those arrivals, plenty of people who are eligible to apply for SIJ. So, yeah, New York is a very important state in this national conversation.
Now, everything we're talking about, it can be a little complicated, dry, nuanced. We're talking about status changes among people that are interacting with the government. There's all types of bureaucratic language, you know, SIJ, S-I-J, deferment, all of this. But it has real impacts on people in their real lives, which is exactly why you opened up your article with the story of Carlos Guerra León. I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about what his case shows us about how these changes play out in people's real lives.
Yeah, thank you for that question. So Carlos is an 18-year-old recent graduate of Spring Valley High School. He lives in Rockland County. He has SIJ, and he did receive deferred action under the Biden administration, but he was driving to work very early one Saturday morning, headed to a local car wash on August 9th when ICE pulled him over, I guess runs his information, sees that he has a removal order from when he was 12 years old, years ago. And they say essentially that the deferred action is no longer kind of a protection for him. And so he is arrested and sent to a detention center in Louisiana, where he remains. So what that shows, I think, is that even for the people who do have deferred action, the Trump administration's posture towards the SIJ program means that they no longer really see those people as deserving of protection from immigration enforcement. And so, you know, even people like Carlos who had deferred action are now vulnerable. But certainly people who are caught in that backlog where they're applying for SIJ but not receiving deferred action, I think are probably even more so.
Okay, this is somebody who just recently graduated from high school in the Hudson Valley and could be working, could be gainfully employed, yeah, could be contributing to society right now, but has been locked up for almost the last month now.
Yeah. It's going to be a month tomorrow, actually, September 9th. And his attorney is trying to get him released, has sent in information, including a letter of recommendation from his employers who say, you know, he was always early for his shifts, which often started at 7 a.m., and they very much oppose his detention. I think his mother told me, you know, she had always worried for herself, and she had a lot of conversations with Carlos and his sister about what would happen to them if she were to be deported. But because they both had SIJ and deferred action, you know, she told me she had never feared for them in this way.
And are there other ways that communities in New York are responding to this issue right now? What can people do, even if there are support networks? Like, what steps are they taking?
Yeah, that's a great question. I heard from grassroots, you know, community organizations that one of the things they're trying to do right now is actually help more young people apply for SIJ if they are eligible for it. You know, the idea being that even though the protections are being eroded, it is still better to have some form of status or process underway than to have none. So there is an organization in New York City that has really scaled up its efforts to help young people apply for that. Otherwise, I think there's a lot of advocacy happening around this issue. The hearing was quite crowded. And as far as I could tell, most of the people there were kind of on the plaintiff's side. So there's a lot of energy around trying to show up to advocate for SIJ. And I also met at the hearing one person who is a young New Yorker who was actually caught in this backlog himself. He applied for SIJ. Received it in July, but did not get deferred action at that time. And so he's, you know, working on his degree here in New York City in computer science, and very much hoping that in the next months and years, but hopefully months, the situation will be resolved so that he can, you know, get a work permit and be able to start his career when he finishes his education.
So people are starting to react to this, you know, family members and community members on a case-by-case basis. But there's also people getting together to file a lawsuit, or have they already filed it? What's the status?
The lawsuit was filed in July. It is a national class action lawsuit on behalf of SIGE-approved young people with SIGE and some legal aid organizations. It was filed in the Eastern District of New York. And five of the named plaintiffs are New Yorkers, so kind of representing the importance of SIGE to New York. They're among the people challenging this policy directly. There were oral arguments in the case this past Thursday, and we are now waiting to see what the judge decides. The plaintiffs asked him to issue a preliminary injunction that would essentially return us to the Biden-era deferred action policy. I will say the judge had pretty pointed questioning for both sides. It seems to me, you know, I maybe shouldn't prognosticate, but it didn't seem to me that he was inclined to give either side everything that they were asking for. He did ask for supplemental briefing on a kind of general legal question having to do with when an agency has the authority to make a change like the one the Biden administration made with deferred action. So it was a pretty technical hearing, but the bottom line is we are still waiting to see what happens with that lawsuit.
All right. Well, I appreciate you, you know, breaking down all of this, everything behind this story, because, again, this issue and any individual aspect of it is not as simple as many folks who are out there talking about it make it seem sometimes. There's a lot of nuance. There's a lot of kind of bureaucratic information and history to wade through here. Along those lines, you're the immigration reporter for New York Focus, and this is your first article, I think, right?
Yeah, this is a very new position for me. I'm new to covering New York. I was a local reporter in Mississippi for 4 years and then spent a year on the national desk at the New York Times right before this. So I have a lot to learn and really welcome tips. Would love to hear from your listeners anytime if there's something I should be paying attention to or something I should know. Welcome emails and phone calls and any kind of contact.
Right. And I'm just wondering, you just talk a bit, especially as you're starting this new role and essentially forging ahead with a new beat for New York Focus. Like what's important about this beat right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've been thinking a lot about, you know, how to think of this beat as a local reporter. Obviously, it is dominating national headlines. But what I am aiming to do is really show how New York state and local policies and dynamics are shaping the lives of immigrants here and how New York immigrant communities shape the lives of everyone who lives in the state. And so I'm really trying to think about New York specifically, and things that I think are kind of interesting themes to look at are the ways in which Trump administration policies are affecting young people. SIGE is a really good example of that because New York does have so many young immigrants. I'm also really interested in how sanctuary policies are working in practice and, you know, the tension between New York state's overall kind of posture as a state that welcomes immigrants, while at the same time there are local communities, including sheriff's departments, certain parts of the state that are very much interested in collaborating with ICE and CBP on immigration enforcement. So I think that is kind of a key area of interest and focus for me right now.
I will remind everybody that your work is up now at nysfocus.com. We've been talking to Isabel Taft, who covers immigration for New York Focus. Isabel, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. Well, New Yorkers can now get the COVID vaccine directly at pharmacies, and this is after an emergency executive order signed by Governor Kathy Hochul on Friday. The order was aimed at clearing up confusion coming to the state because of shifting policies at the federal level. What's the impact of this order, and what does it mean for New Yorkers? Tim Bruno spoke with Dr. James McDonald, Health Commissioner for New York State.
What it mainly does is eliminate the confusion. You can go to the pharmacy and get the vaccine like you normally did in years previous. Prior to this executive order, because of the way the federal government constructed this year, over 7 million New Yorkers are going to be considered unable to get the vaccine. That was a problem. So now your pharmacist can just give you the vaccine like they normally would, and they're happy to do it.
Which groups were most at risk of losing access without this emergency order?
Yeah, so children were one of the biggest groups that weren't going to get access to the vaccine, which was a mistake. Because when you look at hospitalization rates, 6 months to 2 years, that group was the third highest group for ending up in the hospital. Another group that was really going to miss out on getting the vaccine were people who were pregnant. And another group was anyone between 18 and 65 who just didn't have an underlying health condition. And all those groups up, you're a little over 7 million New Yorkers.
And can you, how quickly will New Yorkers actually see pharmacies offering the updated COVID shot under this new order?
Yeah, so some of the pharmacies were waiting for this order, so they should start seeing vaccine come in next week. There were other pharmacies in particular that already had the vaccine, but they didn't know if they could give it without a patient-specific order, so they're ready now. In other words, many of the pharmacies were just simply waiting for clarity to do this. Because keep in mind, prior to this executive order, if your doctor sent over an order for you, you can get the vaccine. But that's a barrier, really, when you think about it, because you have to contact your doctor. Your doctor has to send the prescription over to the pharmacy, and the pharmacist has to do it. It's much easier if you can just simply go to the pharmacy yourself and get the vaccine. One of the things I did today, too, was send over a standing order. So I have a standing order now in every pharmacy in New York State. So if you want to go get the vaccine, you can go get the vaccine. We'd love you to do that.
In terms of public confidence, why was it important to give pharmacists the authority not just to administer, but also to prescribe the vaccine?
Yeah, this was important because the way the federal guidance came out this year, we had some people who didn't have an indication for the vaccine. So if you're otherwise healthy, you're one of the group of over 7 million New Yorkers who didn't meet their very strict criteria, then you would be getting the vaccine off-label. That's why we had to give the pharmacist the authority to prescribe the vaccine to you and administer the vaccine to you. So that's what was different. It's because the federal guidance this year, not only was it confusing, not only was it chaotic, it was very different than last year.
And with this federal uncertainty, how have the government's funding cuts and changes to advisory committees, for example, affected New York's planning for this fall and winter?
Yeah, so it is not affecting New York as much because we're still a very large, strong health department. So we actually had our own ideas of what we wanted to do. And really, one of the things we did today as well is we sent out provider advisories to healthcare providers so they knew exactly where we were coming from this. So we made sure we sent in a health advisory for people taking care of people who are pregnant. We also sent a health advisory out for people taking care of children, and then another advisory for everybody else, just so they knew what is our expert guidance on giving the COVID vaccine, because there's been so much confusion from the federal government. We did our own research, got our own experts, made our own determinations, and sent people our own guidance so they knew from us what were the things they should be doing.
The governor calls this order a stopgap. What might a permanent legislative solution look like?
Yeah, so I think one of the things we would love to see in this next legislative session is changes to the law so pharmacists can actually do these things, but also stop relying on the advisory committee of immunization practices. We thought that was going to be safe forever, but what you really saw with how this has changed on the federal level is we can no longer rely on the advisory committee. So we need to have other words in legislation that allow me as the commissioner to rely on other authorities so we can make the best decisions for you.
Could this move set a precedent for how New York handles access to other vaccines beyond COVID?
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see, because right now, other vaccines, there isn't a problem with them right now. I am concerned about the direction of what I see in the federal government. I'm very concerned with, just quite frankly, the attack on vaccines. Many of them have been around for over six decades. Our vaccines are the safest we've ever known. I've been a pediatrician for over 35 years. We have absolutely the best vaccines for children and for adults. And yet we see all this attack from what I think is, quite frankly, an uninformed federal government. It really concerns me.
Are you concerned also on just the attack on science and the proven precedent of these, not just vaccines, but just medical practice?
You know, I am concerned. I mean, one of the things I see is, you know, talk is cheap. You know, make America healthy again. That's a slogan. But actions speak louder than words. What I'm seeing is a systematic undermining of things that would make us healthy. An attack on vaccines, attack on fluoride, funding cuts in the National Institute of Health, undermining medical breakthroughs. funding cuts to our federal partners, strategies that are going to uninsure all these people in America by 2027. I'm not seeing anything that's making anyone healthy again. And so quite frankly, the actions that speak to me are ones that make us look like we're becoming unhealthier. I don't see anything going on to protect anybody in the United States right now from the federal government, which is so important why health departments, state health departments in particular, are strong, reliable, expert sources of information. And I think people should really be getting the information from us right now because we're objective. We're not a political entity. Our job as a state health department is protect and promote your health and well-being. That's it. We don't have anything else at stake except your health and well-being.
Yeah, New York is working with other Northeast states and other Northeast state health departments. How will collaborating strengthen vaccine access and public health preparedness and education regionally?
Yeah, we've enjoyed collaborating with the Northeastern states and some of the bigger cities. I think it's very healthy for health departments to collaborate. It's not just about vaccines, though. We've had great conversations about that. We've also been collaborating on certain laboratory tests, data sharing. There's a lot of things we can do to help protect public health in general. And it's good when public health professionals collaborate. Keep in mind, when public health people talk to each other, what you hear is normal, rational conversations that look at evidence and science. And we're very polite to each other. There's just not hostility or toxicity. It's refreshing, quite frankly. And I think this is why the collaboration is so important. But just to be sure, we collaborate with other states as well. Like I talk to the California Department of Health, quite frankly, every month. And I talk to other state health departments very often as well. Public health people, we love to collaborate because we really do have the public's best interest in mind.
Can you give an example or a step the group has already agreed upon in terms of preparedness or collaborating?
Yeah, so I think you'll see more of that coming out in the future. But one of the things I saw that was a good example, we got together in Providence 2 weeks ago. And really, one of the things we agreed upon was, one, what are we going to call ourselves? The Northeast Public Health Collaborative. That was one thing. Other things we agreed upon was, like, how are we going to talk to each other? What is our meeting cadence going to be? But really, we were aligned a lot on where we saw vaccine strategy going as well. And one of the things you see with most states is they really do want anyone who wants a COVID vaccine in particular to get a COVID vaccine. There's a lot of uniform opinion on that, which is different than what the federal government's saying right now.
Do you expect other states to follow New York's lead if federal guidance continues to lag?
I do. I think other state health departments, by the way, are looking for guidance, by the way. Like, I talk to other state health departments all the time, but, you know, we do share ideas with each other. But I think what other states' health departments are saying is, who can do what? You know, there's a divide and conquer approach to public health. You know, when it comes to sharing data, it'd be better to have regional data than just state health, you know, state data. Keep in mind, New York's a huge state. We get a lot of data. But some of the smaller states in particular can benefit from when you work with a larger state to sort of see that bigger picture to things here. So I'm a little bit optimistic about where public health can go, because one thing I'm seeing is because there's all this federal uncertainty, I see state health departments really much more collaborative with each other. In other words, we're just finding that we have to solve these problems on our own. And I think that's overall not going to be a bad idea at all.
Given some of these attacks on public health and how it has weakened public trust, weakened public trust in vaccines, what's your message to New Yorkers who might be hesitant about getting a COVID vaccine?
You know, I think just look at the COVID vaccine in particular. In 2024, over 50,000 people in New York were admitted to a hospital related to COVID. Over 2,775 people died related to COVID. Just to put that 2,775 number in context, that's like 6 747s worth of people. This is more than people who died from influenza. Just to, you know, give you some number, like for every person admitted to a hospital for flu, over 2 people are still admitted related to COVID. So COVID's a significant disease. You've been confused by a lot of, I think, just non-experts giving you, you know, inappropriate information. The COVID vaccine is probably the most studied vaccine in the history of our country. It's safe. It's the best protection out there. I'm looking forward to getting mine, quite frankly.
That's New York State Health Commissioner Dr. James McDonald. Dr. McDonald, thank you for taking the time to walk us through these developments.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you, Tim Bruno. Remember, you can hear Tim every weekday morning at 10 with the latest local news and conversations on Radio Chatskill. I'm Jason Dole. I'm here with you on the Local Edition around this time every evening. But that's it for the Local Edition. I'll be back tomorrow night at 6 to do it all over again. For now, stay with us. We have more news coming up from The Daily. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.
WJFF Jeffersonville.